well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. Robert Wilcox, and we're going to be talking about Target Patton. It's the story of the murder of General Patton, George Patton. Most people find it difficult to believe that this sort of thing could really go on in the real world, but those of you who have heard our story of the what happened to the USS Liberty, the intelligence ship off the coast of Sinai during the 67 war, which was attacked by Israeli planes, but with the full knowledge and support of the people in Washington, D.C., and they intended all of those sailors to be killed, and we've interviewed them, and they were threatened with not only imprisonment, but death if they ever told the true story of what happened. But the story of George Patton is certainly one of the most important stories of our time, and we're indebted to Mr. Wilcox, who's spent a great deal of time and effort to gather the facts surrounding the death of George Patton. Mr. Wilcox, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stan. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you, and I'm just going to let you tell the story because, of course, I may interrupt from time to time, but you go right ahead because this is a fascinating story. How did you get involved, the idea that people in Washington, D.C. could want to kill one of the most dramatic generals of the Second World War? I mean, the idea that people in our own government would plot the death of one of our leading generals. How did you ever get involved in this story?
Well, I was like most people today. If they know General Patton from the movie and so on, a great general, but I was under the impression that he had died in a routine accident, which is what most people think. I have a cousin who is a detective. That is, he has a detective agency, and he deals with the clandestine a lot. And we were working out one day, and he said to me, No, it wasn't an accident. It was murder. And I said, well, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I know a guy who can actually tell you about it. And this person that he put me onto, I'm jumping ahead a little for myself, but he was an OSS agent. His name is Douglas Bezzata. And he eventually told me, I went to see him and interviewed him, and that he had actually been ordered by a Wild Bill Donovan, the head of the OSS, to stage the accident that killed Patton. Now, let me back up and say that injured him and led to his death. General Patton died in 1945 in December. He had been literally responsible for literally winning the war in Europe. He had dashed through France. He had the Germans on the run, he was our greatest, in my opinion, tactical and fighting general. But after the war, he had always looked at the Russians as the kind that they were, and he was against the Russians. He wanted to go to war with them right after World War II. He said, we might as well fight them now, we're gonna have to fight them sometime. Because they had taken over all of Eastern Europe, and he saw through them. He saw what they were really doing. Our administration at the time did not. This is the Roosevelt-Truman administration. They thought that the Russians were some kinds of great peacemakers, and that FDR called Stalin Uncle Joe.
Now, I'm going to have to interrupt you there because we're going to go to a break. But, of course, literally every woman in Eastern Europe was raped at the end of the Second World War by the Russian army. They were given full privilege to do it. Never mentioned here in the United States. I wonder why our leaders didn't tell us about that. Well, you go right ahead, Robert.
Okay. should I continue?
Yeah, you go right ahead. You just we will take little breaks from time to time, but you go right ahead.
Oh, well, as I was saying, so he saw this, and the entire administration did not like this. They didn't like him, and there actually was, as we look at the whole picture, there was an order out early in the war, 1943, really, even before Patton got there, to stop Patton, both because of jealousy and also because of his views. And they actually, Patton, he roared through France and had the Germans on the run. They were in disarray, and the Germans themselves will tell you this. In September 44, he was poised to go in and end the war. This would have been 8 months before the war ended. And think of all the lives that would have been saved. But they stopped him. They stole his gas. They took his gas from him and gave it to Montgomery. Now, I say they. This was General Eisenhower. Eisenhower was a great diplomat, but he was a terrible war fighter, and he had made a series of blunders. And this was one of his biggest, because he decided to let British General Montgomery try and go in and win the war, take Berlin. Montgomery failed at the famous bridge too far. And here was Patton literally crying, let me do it. And as a result of not letting Patton continue what he had just started, the Germans were able to regroup themselves and hit us at the Battle of the Bulge, which easily could have kicked us out of France. So the only person who could save General Eisenhower was Patton, and he was able to go up there and help these brave guys who were fighting, who were holding off the Germans, but under great duress, and stop the Battle of the Bulge. So anyway, Patton, I think the point here is that Patton was a great general. He could have ended the war earlier, but once the war ended, they put him back in a backwater, literally doing some studies of some kind. He should have been over fighting the Japanese. And this plot had begun as stop Patton, taking his gas and so on. But by the end of the war, I believe it morphed into kill Patton. And as I started off, I found this former OSS agent, Douglas Bezzotta, who had been told by the OSS in a series of meetings by the head of the OSS.
You hold that thought right there. We're going to be back here in just a moment as we bring our stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Robert is talking about the fact that Patton certainly could have won the war 8 months before it ended if they just let him go ahead. They actually had to cut off his gasoline supplies. They didn't want him to end the war, supposedly. They were going to let Montgomery do this. They knew, though, that Patton would have gone right on into eastern, into Berlin, and probably would have taken the eastern part of Germany as well, and that wasn't in the plan. And so when the war ended, of course, why Patton felt that we should go to war with the Russians. We were going to have to fight them sooner or later. But he was, of course, relegated to a relatively menial task. And then, of course, why this OSS agent that Robert had talked to actually had gone to a series of meetings where the discussion was there. The predecessor of the CIA under Bill Donovan, it was the intelligence gathering agency during the Second World War, how to kill Patton. So why did they want to kill Patton? Why were they so afraid of this man?
Because he was about ready to go home, and he was two reasons. He was going to agitate to fight the Soviets. Now, he was like number two or three in popularity at that time. He might very well have been elected president. I doubt that, but it could have happened. He certainly could have been elected to an office like senator or something. And his main thing was to go home and start fighting these Russians and stop them from taking over Europe and doing what they were doing. And he also knew secrets, like the secret of that I just spoke about, Eisenhower had blown it big time. And we could have ended the war. He was livid about this. That the war could have been ended, there would have been more people saved, more Americans saved. There's an earlier story in France about the Falaise Gap. This was an area early in France that he could have encircled the same people who came back in the Battle of the Bulge and killed them there. He was stopped again by Eisenhower. And so he knew these secrets. He wanted to agitate against the Russians. And believe me, our FDR and that administration, they didn't want to hear this. They were so mad about this. I'll give you one story. FDR commissioned a study to find out who killed all of the Polish leaders at Katyn. This happened in 43. It was early in the war. The reason they killed them all, the Russians did, was to cut out all of their leaders so they could take over the country. But they blamed it on the Germans. And FDR commissioned a study to find out about it. And when he found out it was the Russians, he squelched the thing. He wouldn't allow anyone to know this. So that's the kind of thing that Patton was up against. The whole administration did not want to hear this. And so we come to the point of this, that he's in a backwater, and he's about ready to leave and go home. And he decides on the day before he leaves to take a little jaunt down south and go hunting. And he leaves in a car. It's a big Cadillac limousine. There's two people in the back, General Patton and his aide, General Gay, and there's a driver. And they're on a remote road outside of Mannheim, Germany, and there's this truck. The Cadillac is stopped for a railroad passing. Once it starts up, it's not going very fast. This army truck is up ahead of them on this two-lane highway, and it pulls out. It was waiting for them. And it pulls out and comes almost abreast, and then it turns suddenly without any signal, and there's no way they can go but hit him. And they hit that truck, and Patton, out of the three people, Patton is the only one injured. Patton ends up with a broken neck. He has a gash in his face. The other two people in the car are not even scratched. And this is the beginning of the mystery. And the person driving that truck was a very nefarious guy. I found out about him, too. I had to track him down. I didn't track him down. He died. But he is whisked away from there. This is the at this accident scene, this man has just turned a truck with no signal, for no reason, has caused the highest-ranking general in Germany to break his neck, and they just let him go. He disappears. Actually, I'm told later that he's whisked away to London. I don't know what happened to him there, but anyway, he's not interrogated, and there are no reports from the accident. When the accident happened in this remote area, suddenly there are literally a whole gang of people that hit that accident area, including a brigadier general. All very strange. This is a remote area. Nobody knew he was there, but all these people come out. So he is taken not to a hospital in Mannheim, Germany, but he's taken to a hospital. It's about 30 miles away in Heidelberg, and they expect him to die. But he doesn't die. He's a tough guy. He rallies. And within about a week and a half, he's doing so well, they're going to go ahead and fly him all the way home to Boston, which was no easy trip in those days. But he was doing that well.
Was he quadriplegic? This is the story we got. It was that he was paralyzed from the neck down as a result of the injury. Was that true or not?
He was paralyzed. Yes, that is true. But there were signs of him coming back.
Right.
He could twitch his fingers. But he was. He was paralyzed there, but they were going to send him home. And suddenly, and all of his bodily functions and everything are doing fine. We have the records of that. But he has a downturn, a sudden downturn, and within about 14 hours, he dies. And there's no autopsy. And there is subsequent good information, and Bazzotta told me as well, and Bazzotta's not the only one involved in this, I'll go on to others, but that the Russians came in and they poisoned him. At this time, we were developing poisons that could mimic natural occurrences. And the what he was said to have died of was a, and you're a doctor, you know about this, was an embolism, traveling, and which is something that does happen to people who are laying on the in a hospital for,
yeah,
for a while.
Yes, but you should do an autopsy to find out for certain.
I mean,
that was what we were doing in those days. We tried to find out why people died, and especially, you know, a four-star general.
Absolutely, and they didn't. And there was no autopsy, and he was buried. Well, if we look today now and try to find, we can find the medical records, but all of the records of the accident are gone. And we're not talking about one or two. I know for sure in other records they are mentioned. There were at least two reports by police at that accident. They've vanished. There were several other investigations. They have vanished. At least five that we know of vanished. You can't find these reports, anything about the accident. And I would say there's about eight of them that are really gone, but that's not a, a coincidence. That's a cover-up. Now, the other person that that I tracked down was a gentleman named Stephen Skubic. And he was a CIC agent. That was the counterintelligence corps. He was serving with Patton at this time when all of this happened. And before the accident, he was dealing with Russians, with Ukrainians who were not Russians. They're Ukrainians, but they were infiltrated into the NKVD and the Russian intelligence services. And they were telling him, "Hey, tell Patton, he's on the death list. Stalin has put him on the death list. He's to be killed by the KGB." And Stephen Skubic went back, and he was directed by his higher-ups to go to the OSS and tell them. And he actually was directed to Wild Bill Donovan, who had first tried to put him in jail, and then he had to go home under the threat of death. And lived that way for 5 or 6 years because he found out, and it wasn't just from one person, he found out from three top sources that the Russians had put Patton on this death list. Now, the OSS, people don't generally know this, but the OSS had forged an alliance with the NKVD, the forerunner of the KGB, in 1943. And so the two of them were working together. So it makes perfect sense that they would have been collaborating with this. And Bazzara told me that he had a an Eastern European working with him to stage that accident. And I can go into the details of the accident, but there are several other high points of this story that that I should say first. And one of them is that the car that is supposedly the car that Patton was in is supposed to be at the Patton Museum in Fort Knox. And I thought, well, good, at least I'll get to see some piece of the crime, so to speak, go actually and be able to look at that car. Well, I took an expert from Detroit, actually the Cadillac expert for those Cadillacs. It's a 1938 Cadillac 7533 model. And this expert went with me, and what we determined was that that's a fake. It's not the real car there. The actual car that he was hit in is nowhere. It's disappeared too. And you can see that this would have been so good for me to look at. I could have seen. The story goes that Patton, unlike the other two in the car, flew through the air, literally, in the back. It was a large limousine. He was in the back seat. And when they hit the other car, that he flew through the air, and he hit a barrier where the driver is driving, and that's how he broke his neck, and then he catapulted back, which never made any sense to me, because if he did that, why didn't the other guy sitting next to him do the same thing? Well, without the car, you can't really see how this would have developed. But I was able to get in addition to find out that the car is not the car that we thought it was that's at Fort Knox, you can see where the VIN number of it has been scratched out. Someone purposely said that it was the car when it wasn't, and they took this VIN number out.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, go ahead, pick up the story.
I think that the VIN number should be explained. That's something that they use today. It's a vehicle identification number, and it's on the check.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iOtterol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
He was an out accident. A third was when he was in a small Piper aircraft, a small plane, when he's flying over Germany, and apparently a Polish fighter plane, four or four of them there, three of them stay aloft, one of them comes down, tried to shoot down the little Piper plane that Patton is flying in. Why would anybody, after the war is over, try to shoot down a little Piper airplane? There'd be no question what it was, but there was an order out to kill Patton from the OSS. From our own government, the highest levels, they were going to kill this general because, of course, he was a potential threat to the power structure. So pick up the story there.
Yeah, with going back to that airplane thing, the guy who tried to shoot him down, thank goodness Patton had a good pilot, and the Spitfire crashed. And the last entries in both Patton's aide and in his diary and in Patton's diary is, what the heck is this about? We're going to get to the bottom of this. But then you don't find anything else. We don't know what happened there. And as you so rightly said, why would anybody do something like that? Why would they be shooting him? Well, it looks to me like that was a part of that plot, and they could have easily said, oh, just an accident. We didn't know it was him in the plane. Well, I don't believe that. So that ended that. Now, when we go back to Douglas Bezzada, he's a very, very interesting guy and story. He was a sort of a James Bond and a Lawrence of Arabia. He was one of the Jedburghs. Now, the Jedburghs are the beginning of our special forces, and he was dropped behind Nazi lines to organize the French resistance. But part of his plan, he told me, was also to stop Patton. This was something that they had told him. I never could find out who told him that. It probably was Donovan. But anyway, this was way before this 1945 incident. This is in 44, right after D-Day. But the point being that Douglas Bezzada is a sterling and a Jedburg. He won many medals, as many as any OSS guy, and he was very, very courageous. And that's why they picked him to be this kind of OSS assassin. And I was quite shocked to learn that there were people like this. But these assassins also not only killed enemies, they would even kill our own people if they thought they were talking too much or they were ordered to. And Bezzada agonized a lot over this order to kill Patton when he got it. He didn't really know what to do, but and in his diaries, which are very key in Target Patton, in my book Target Patton, is a series of 8 meetings that he has with Donovan. And by the way, these are not meetings where you have, you know, they write up a memo about it. This is all very secret stuff. But at the time that they actually discuss the death, and this is a metamorphosis. It goes from stop Patton to kill Patton. In that meeting, Bezzada was told to meet Wild Bill Donovan in a London hotel, a restaurant. They were off on the side, and they had a discussion, and it went something like this. Oh, my, Douglas, we have a terrible problem. This great patriot, he's going to ruin everything that we've set up. We just can't control him. He's crazy. He wants to fight the Russians. And so we've got to do something. And Bezzada he's a very, very, a guy who didn't fear anything or anybody. And he didn't like Donovan, but he kind of played Donovan. He went, well, sir, what would you have me do? I'm your man. I'm going to do whatever you need me to do. And Donovan said something to the effect, well, we've just got to stop him. You have to do what you have to do. And Bezzada says, well, do you mean kill him, sir? And Donovan said, well, you do what you have to do. And that's the kind of thing that was in this diary, and with a lot of detail. And the first thing I did after I met Bezzada was, and I spent a week with him and taped all the interviews with him, and it was a delicate thing to go into. And by the way, he would have never talked to me, I do not believe. He was 85 when I got to him. If he had not had a stroke and was ready to talk, and also he felt so bad about this thing, so there were a number of reasons why he would have talked. I hear you want to take a break here?
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to. But anyway, of course, this is a fascinating story. And I mean, I bet professional assassins employed by our government, certainly I've interviewed 3 of them. One of them was subsequently killed. He was the man who was assigned the job of killing Ross Perot. He refused to carry it out. And his body, of course, I'm told, washed up on the beaches here this last year.
You know.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan Beck here, and you go right ahead, Robert.
Well, I was going to say that was a telling story you just told, because Bezzano said he knew that if he turned it down, he would be killed. Another accident. And by the way, accident, this kind of accident that George Patton died in, was the typical way that both the OSS and the NKVD like to do it. An accident is perfect. It looks like something that you could say is an accident, and it just doesn't bring much suspicion. And if you blow it, sometimes they do. They don't kill who they want to kill. You can always get them in the hospital. In a hospital, a person is vulnerable, and so those two things. In Target Patton, you will see that there were many other accidents that weren't really accidents that Stalin used to love to do that. He killed several people, and Stalin was a madman and a killer of the first degree. He would sit in his office with a list of people, and it was like playing a crossword puzzle. If you got a check near your name, you were dead. They were going to kill you. And he did this every morning. I mean, it was just part and parcel. But this was a typical way to kill someone. And in any case, Bezzano, I went to the National Archives after spending a lot of time with him, and the first thing I wanted to do was check out everything he told me. And luckily, at that time, this was in the late 90s, the OSS files, which had been kept secret for so long, were open. And everything he told me was true. This man was not a liar. And subsequently, people I know who knew him told me he was never a liar. He did, you know, a clandestine like that, is their whole life is never to talk and never to say anything. And that's why I say I would have never gotten him to tell me this stuff if it hadn't have been for the fact that he had a stroke, that he felt bad about all this. And by the way, his father was a very famous Presbyterian minister and famous athlete, as Bezzano was. And he felt bad for that reason, his wife told me that at night she would hear him praying. And in his diaries, you see things like, God, why have you done this to me? Why do you make me this? You know, why do you give me these talents that I? And then he would turn and he would almost, when he was telling me how he did this, set up this accident. He would almost smile at how he did it. You know, professional.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Mr. Wilcox is telling us that you were talking to this gentleman who had arranged the accident that killed General Patton. The man really had a great deal of feeling of guilt about it. He talked to him when he was 85. He had already had a stroke. He had been involved with a number of clandestine activities for our government. Always was told that it was justified that these people were a threat to the establishment. He explained how he set up this accident, where Patton was, of course, severely injured, so that he had to be taken to the hospital. So you pick up the story there.
Yeah, I wanted to say real quickly that this is a mystery. And I think if I went to a court, if I went to a grand jury, I'd get an indictment, because we're talking about seven or eight pieces of this: the mysterious accident, this mysterious downturn in the hospital, the two eyewitnesses who are Bezzano and Skubic, who will attest to this at that time, and who are sterling witnesses. They ended their careers, both of them, working for Reagan. Bezzano was an aide to John Lehman, the Secretary of the Navy, and Skubic ended his career as a an operative for the Republican Party, and ending it with the Reagan administration. These were not people you can just throw away, and I think we've talked about motive. You know, motive is the easiest part here. He wanted to start the war with the Russian. We have just fought the greatest war in history. Nobody wanted to do that. And he also was going to tell secrets that would have ruined careers. Those two are the strongest, but there are a whole lot of more motives that are possibilities. And then we have the fake car. We have the earlier attempts against him. I mean, it is just, as you go down the line, I think that a grand jury would easily give us an indictment. Now, let me go back to the accident and tell you how Bezzotta said that he set this thing up, because it's very interesting. He said that he got a special type of rifle. This was not from a charge like a, you know, a powder or anything. It was air-blown. It didn't make a lot of noise. But it would shoot something like a piece of metal or a rock. When it would go in, it wouldn't go through someone. It would just hit them, and it easily could have broken the neck, and that's what he said happened. And then it would fall down into the debris, and nobody would know any different. There's not a bullet there. There's just a piece of rock. In his case, he said it was kind of a bolt that he shot. And the Patton was, this lonely road was a road full of war materials, all types of broken debris, like, tanks, and all kinds of stuff was stacked on the side of the road. And when they were driving down it, Patton is looking out the right side, and General Gay, his aide, is looking out the left side, and the driver is looking ahead. Nobody saw what happened to Patton. So Bezzotta set up this truck. He said he gave liquor and some money to these guys who were going to drive the truck. They didn't even know who they were going to hit. They were just taking it. They were contract guys, and they were going to drive this truck. When he gave the signal, here's the Cadillac coming. And that's what the witness of the driver of Patton's Cadillac says. There was a truck on the side of the road, and it was stopped. And when he after the train went by, then and they started their Cadillac up, why this truck started up and came towards them, which is exactly what Bezzotta told me had happened. And they had another truck, which would, in effect, where the traveling truck, the one that was to turn in front of Patton's car, when that truck turned, there was another truck that was positioned near where Bezzotta was, and he's hiding behind all of this debris. And it would have forced the Cadillac into a killing lane. And so when that happened, Bezzotta had a shot that might have been about 20 feet. And here's what it is reported that Patton was saying when the accident occurs, just before the crash, and he's looking out at this debris. He's looking to the right on the side of the road. He says, "Look at that." Now, what does he see when he says, "Look at that"? Is he seeing someone in there pointing something at him? I think that's as good as anything else. But the other guy, the man on the other side, he's on the left. He's looking on the other side of the road. So nobody sees what happens to Patton, and, of course, the driver's looking ahead. And when it smashes into the truck, and it's just really a fender bender, Patton is said to fly across the, up maybe 4 feet and then come catapulting back. But I had a veteran from the Los Angeles Police Department, the accident squad, and she really showed me how that couldn't have happened. The Cadillac did not hit square into the truck. What it did was it hit on the right corner of the right fender, because the driver turned the car towards the middle of the road. And when he did that, the whole axis of the way everyone would have flown forward changed. Instead of flying the distance of that compartment, Patton looking out of the door, he would have hit the door. And this is the professional opinion of this accident investigator. So Patton is looking out. He says, "Look at that. What's that?" And suddenly he gets hit in the face, because that's where he has a terrible it's a cut in the face that literally you can lift up the skin of his forehead and a little bit of his nose and see the bone. And it goes from the bridge of the nose all the way up to the middle of his head. I think he's hit by this in the face, and then that shoves him, which is much more feasible, shoves him the foot or so next to the man sitting next to him, and he ends up on top of General Gay. And that's how that happened. And so you can see that the explanation they gave in the first place was not based on anybody seeing it, and it doesn't make sense. But the explanation that Posada gives does make sense. So once the crash ended, there is Patton on top of General Gay on the other side of the seat, and he's bleeding profusely. And it's then that he says, I can't feel my arms and my legs. And then all these people come out of the woodwork. An ambulance eventually gets there. There is a brigadier general there. There must be four sets of different types of police that come there. And I don't mean regular police. These are military police. All types of mysterious figures, most of whom you can never find again. They are mentioned in newspaper reports, little bits and pieces, but you can't find them. And I tried. All of the reports are gone, as I said before. So that's the beginning of it. And then we go to the hospital, and there are good records in the hospital. And what happened to him in the hospital, there was no autopsy. We'll never know. I am advocating that we dig up the remains, like they did to, I believe, Zachary Scott, and test these the remains, because they might be able today to find these poisons. One of the Patton family was approached in the last 20 years. She went to Eastern Europe. It was the granddaughter of the Pattons, and a Russian colonel, she said, approached her and said he wanted to tell her something about what had happened to her grandfather, to Patton, and that they had killed him. They had sprayed something that had caused pneumonia in him. That's a little different than the poison that that Bazzata says was administered. He says cyanide was administered, and it was administered in some way that it would dissipate and it would cause those embolisms. I'm not sure about those scientific facts or not, but I am sure that we were making these kinds of poisons at that time to use as killing poisons that would mimic things like embolism, and then they would, and so were the Russians. So that happened at the hospital.
Well, now, do you think that it was the Russians that were responsible for poisoning him, or do you think it was the OSS? Do you think that they were working together?
They were working together on the overall plot. Posada said he tried to go to the hospital after they did not kill him at the accident, but he was not able to get to him. So Posada was always able to say, I didn't kill him. You know, I put him in the hospital, and the Russians killed him later. So that's the way he told it to me.
And of course, for the people out there, I had the opportunity of speaking to a very highly placed CIA operative. His name was Gunther Rosserocker. And I spent a good deal of time with Gunther before he died. And of course, he was telling me how, as a CIA agent, you know, at least he was with Naval Intelligence, but they were assigned to the CIA, they were working very closely with the KGB, and he described what was going on. I said, that sounds like the story of the Brotherhood of the Rose. I remembered seeing it on television with Robert Mitchum, and he said, that was my story. In fact, the book was dedicated to me. Well, of course, I never knew whether I could believe anything he told me, but the next day I had a copy of the book, and there it was in the foreword, and I specially dedicate this book to Russ, who gave me the information for it. So I believe, of course, the story is true. I believe the KGB and the CIA worked together, but we could never let the American people know that. The Russians are supposed to be the enemies. But is there a real enemy in Moscow, or is there a real enemy in New York City, perhaps, and in Washington, D.C.? Go right ahead.
Well, that's very telling what you say, and I don't know about later, but I do know that, as I said earlier, in 1943, Wild Bill Donovan went to Russia, And he talked right with the head intelligence people of the NKVD, and they forged an alliance. Of course, at that time, the Russians were our allies against the Nazis, and it was smart of him to do that. The thing that he didn't realize, and he never did realize, was that the Russians had already high-placed people all through our government at that time. These were paid spies. I'll tell you how bad it was. Henry Wallace, who was not a spy, but he was the vice president of the United States with FDR. Henry Wallace was he was a socialist, and he was really a dupe. He didn't know what was going on. He was if he had not by chance been taken off the ticket, and Truman put on the ticket just before the last election that elected FDR, we would have had, as part of our cabinet, two paid Russian spies. Lawrence Dugin of the State Department was a communist agent paid by the NKVD, and Harry Dexter White was in Treasury. He was a top Treasury official. Those two people, Henry Wallace has written that he was going to, if he'd have succeeded FDR, he would have appointed them as cabinet members. These were one of many, many paid Russian agents who were steering us, and the whole purpose was, number one, to get us to keep Japan from fighting Russia. That was one thing. So they were able to, the things that these kinds of spies did at high levels was to make it almost for sure that the Japan would fight us and therefore wouldn't fight the Russians. And the other thing was to give Stalin Eastern Europe so that he would have it as a buffer. And they just pulled the wool over our eyes. And you know, McCarthy, whatever you want to say about McCarthy, he was dead right. And the reason why we know that he was right in saying that there were many, many communist agents throughout our government, we now have the Venona papers, which was our breaking of the Russian code during World War II. And that has been kept secret, top secret, until the late 90s. Now it has come out, and we're beginning to see, and these are the Russians, we broke their code, we listened in, and saw who was working for them and who wasn't working for them. And all through the Venona codes, they talk about people like Lawrence Dugin, Harry White, the Rosenbergs, for instance, clearly were paid Russian agents.
But don't forget about Harry Dexter White. He was the number two, right next to the President of the United States.
And yes,
Harry Dexter White was certainly looked upon by the Soviets as a sympathizer. He lived in the White House. He was with the President every day.
Well, this is very true. Actually, Harry White was with Treasury, and I think it was Laughlin Curie,
right?
He was actually the aide to FDR.
Right.
And there's so many more. I mean, one of Wild Bill Donovan's key aides. His last name was Lee, Duncan Lee. He was actually a ancestor of Robert E. Lee, was another paid communist agent. Alger Hiss, whom Nixon, of course you know all this, but a lot of people didn't believe it, and for so long the left has said that these were all lies. They weren't. These were just people who just thought that way. Well, no, they were paid communist agents. We now have the proof of this. So anyway, the Russians already had all these people in place. They didn't need a liaison with the OSS, but they took it because it served their purposes in so many ways. They actually were able to do things like, and I believe, kill Patton, and they had the help of the OSS, because at the time that Patton died, it was clearly by our government they wanted this to happen. He was, as Donovan said, he was a great patriot, but he's about ready to screw up all of our plans. We need the Russians to be our friends. We cannot have someone saying that they're bad and so on. And this is what it led to.
Well, and it's an amazing, amazing story. I have no question. Now, there was another story that was in spotlight in the late 1990s by another gentleman who was actually asked to kill Patton, and he wouldn't do it. What was that story about?
Yeah, that's a good thing that you brought that up. Patton, that actually was Bezzada, and it was the first time that Bezzada, he came out, he didn't say he did it, he said he'd been asked to do it and didn't do it. It's the same man that I tracked down.
All right, fine. He actually did do it then.
He actually did do it, and he just didn't say that at that time. There's a good story behind that if you want to go into that.
Well, we'll do that as soon as we get back here. Anyway, our guest this evening is Robert Wilcox. Well, his book is Target Patton. We're going to carry the book. We think it's an important book, and if you want to get it, you can give us a call. Otherwise, it's available certainly on Amazon.com. It's been widely reviewed in Europe and hardly mentioned at all. And I wonder why. Well, you go right ahead. We were just saying that, of course, your story has been widely covered in the mainstream press in Europe, but for some reason or other, it just hasn't been covered here by the mainstream
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt, that nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
There were no records on what he did. They never keep records for this. And he had to fight for 2 years, literally 2 years, to get a 100% disability. He'd been stabbed, he'd been shot, all these things. And I have all the records of that, and they all agree that he was that. So he became embittered. And when you mentioned this Spotlight story, at that time, he let that be known. He told Spotlight. He didn't know New York Times from Spotlight from anybody. He should have told the New York Times, but he didn't. He told Spotlight because he wanted to sort of sink it to them and say, hey, listen, you guys need to know that our government does this kind of stuff.
And I think it's so important people understand they do. We're out of time, Robert, but I'm looking forward to getting you on our other programs. Thank you very much for writing a wonderful book, Target Patton. And God bless, and we'll be talking to you real soon about getting on all of our other networks.
Thanks a lot, Dr. Stan.
Thank you so
much.
Bye-bye. And then I hope you out there in the listening audience have enjoyed hearing what you have from Mr. Wilcox. And the book, it will be available. You can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We're going to have to order the book and get it in here. We do have a book by another professional assassin, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. Whether he ever killed anybody, he won't admit, but certainly tells us about it. When he was asked to kill Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, who had information about the Kennedy assassination, and of course there are many other stories it tells, but he was trained in assassin school where they told him about how the CIA had arranged for the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. If you doubt that Kennedy was murdered, we've got two great four-tape sets on that, as well as a DVD, as well as two books. One is called The Elite Serial Killers. The other is called A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, but there are two four-tape sets on that. One of them is this interview with Lyndon Johnson's mistress, who tells the story about the meeting held the night before. They ordered the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, interviews with Lee Harvey Oswald, fascinating material you won't get elsewhere, and then an excellent DVD by our good friend Bob Fletcher. And then, of course, if you want to know how they killed Martin Luther King, we have a four-tape set involved with the people who were involved with, who actually attended the trial. Yes, there was a four-month trial put on by Martin Luther King's family, bringing charges against the man. And the jury, after hearing the evidence, said, yes, the government was primarily responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King. We have the book that was written by the man, William Pepper, who was the lawyer there, an active state. You're not going to hear these things talked about on the regular media. If you want to know about how they intended to kill all the American soldiers there, American servicemen on the Liberty, you need to get our four-tape set on the attack on the Liberty. And then, of course, we have a DVD, Dead in the Water, and a video, A Loss of Liberty. The information is there, but you need to get it, and you need to have the information. We even have a syllabus we put together, the various stories about. And these men were told if they ever told the truth, they would be sent to Leavenworth. And several hundred who survived, none of them ever dared come forward for 20 years. Now they're trying to get the information out, but it's being totally blocked out because our media is controlled, ladies and gentlemen. These things are real. I've talked to three assassins, probably four. There was another one, of course, who had been was an assassin. He never would tell us what he did, but this is the sort of thing that really goes on in the real world. Understand that we're dealing with organized evil, and when you do that, so much of this makes sense. This is why you need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to hear my talk on the Forbidden Secret and about the secret societies which are there. The DVD, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and the sequel to that, Riddles in Stone. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our web page is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And we'll be back here in just a few minutes to talk about another fascinating subject. Remember, you can hear us on the internet at radioliberty.com. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Jennifer Lull, and we're going to be talking about the stem cell research. Now, of course, most people, sort of shrug their shoulders. Stem cell research, it's about embryonic stem cells. Should we be sacrificing the potential lives of these frozen embryos? But you have to understand what they're doing, as with so many things, is they're focusing our attention on the wrong issues. Certainly, the taking of human life, and I believe a fertilized ovum is a human life, but embryonic stem cell research does not work. I mean, that's why nobody's doing it. That's why they had to get the stupid taxpayers in California to vote for $3 billion, because certainly no private industry would finance that. But adult stem cell research has had some miraculous, things happen, and it certainly is a remarkable technology that's going to have, I believe, a tremendous advantage for helping people in the future. Well, anyway, Jennifer Lull is going to be talking to us about stem cell research. We'll cover embryonic stem cells, and then I hope we'll get into adult stem cells and the amazing things that have been done experimentally with that, and then the amazing things that have been done in clinical practice. Jennifer, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Why don't you give us just a little bit of background of who you are and how you got involved in studying this, and what the significance of this from an ethical point of view.
Sure. I am the national director of a nonprofit organization that's based out of California called the Center for Bioethics and Culture. And I got really interested in bioethics when I was in graduate school pursuing a degree in bioethics. My background is in pediatric nursing, and I'd worked in healthcare and nursing for over 20 years. So I was very concerned with sort of the exponential growth in science and technology that wasn't necessarily attached to a moral compass. So in my pursuit of my graduate degree, I founded the nonprofit that I now work for, as a means of educating the public that not all scientific, medical, technological progress is necessarily good and ethical, and to help educate people and help them navigate through these sometimes seemingly complex issues.
Well, now, of course, we've been told, and it wouldn't be wonderful if we could really help people who are paraplegic, like Superman, and of course, like this young man named Fox, who actually had Parkinson's disease at a very young age. And certainly, if we could just do something, and of course, they had the television advertisements here in California, tugged on your heartstrings, just vote for this $3 billion bond issue, and not going to cost anything. Bond issues don't cost any money at all. The money's simply somehow free. All you have to do is vote for it, and we're going to come up with miraculous, of course, cures of all sorts of degenerative diseases by embryonic stem cell research. Of course, embryonic stem cell research requires you to kill a viable human being, and certainly at the very early embryonic stages. And unfortunately, the taxpayers of California appropriated these $3 billion. And, of course, the question is, does embryonic stem cell research work? If it works, why do they have to go to the taxpayers? Why do they have to, get this from the people in California? Why won't private industry finance it? We're going to address all these issues here in the program tonight. Well, Jennifer, you pick up the story.
Well, you raised the issue of Michael J. Fox and Christopher Reeve, And unfortunately, a lot of these conversations take place against the backdrop of a lot of hyped up stories of suffering, and we must do something, we have to do something because people are suffering. We certainly see this in the physician-assisted suicide debate. You know, people are suffering. Ought they not have the right to end their own lives? You know, we see it in the abortion debate when the mother's been told that the child is going to be disabled or handicapped or born with Down syndrome, that they're suffering. But again, we have to remind ourselves that though the heavens may fall, there are certain solutions to our suffering that we shouldn't go down those paths. And you raise the point that, you know, the taking of the early, young, tiniest of a member of human life, the embryo, has to be sacrificed in order for the stem cells to be harvested. And that, therein lies the fact with where the debate takes place. There are some that say the human embryo isn't human life yet, or it's human life but it's so small that it doesn't count yet. And there's some of us on the other side who say, no, this is a reasonable position to hold that is consistent with our view of when life begins, when life ends, and that all along that continuum, life should be protected, life has value, life has inherent dignity. So we find ourselves against this backdrop where people say, but people are suffering and people are sick, and therefore we must do this research so that we can find cures for people.
Well, it sounds very good, but is there any evidence that that embryonic stem cell research has done any good, or that certainly that you could utilize this thing? Because my understanding is that certainly embryonic stem cells come from another unique individual. You're made in the image and likeness of God. They have a different genetic makeup, and that there's a terrible tendency either to reject the embryonic stem cells that have been injected, or of course even to form teratomas and tumors.
Right.
What is the truth about this? And
right.
So what is the truth about the effectiveness of embryonic stem cells as they've been applied, you know, to the research, scientific research? And I'm going to let you hold off that and answer that question as soon as we bring all of our other stations back on board here, because I think it's so important that people understand that embryonic stem cell research has been carried out, not in the United States with federal funding, but it's been carried out. And, of course, what has it accomplished? What suffering is it relieved? We'll be back here in just a moment with Jennifer. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, I was just asking Jennifer, what has actually been accomplished with embryonic stem cell research? Because it's been used, certainly not with government funding, but it's been used with private funding to a minor extent here in the United States and elsewhere. Is embryonic stem cell research safe and effective?
Well, you know, so far you're absolutely right. To date, there has been no treatment that has been able to be used in human beings. They have not even been able to get into a human clinical trial with embryonic stem cell research. I do want to correct the record in that under the Bush policy, he did allow federal funding to go forward on a limited amount of embryonic stem cell lines where the embryo had already been created. So under the Bush administration, the National Institute of Health has given out about $160 million of federal money for embryonic stem cell research on embryos that had already been destroyed and the stem cell lines that had already been created. And then what you see is what, in fact, you've identified in Prop 71 and in other states, Missouri, New York, and so on, but California in particular, went to the voters and said, well, we're not going to get a big pile of money from the federal government. We're not going to get a lot of private money because private money wants to see a return on their investment. So let's go to the taxpayers and ask them. And, of course, under the guise of hyped-up fear for people that were sick and needed cures, and these cures were just going to be around the corner if we'd only fund it, and, in fact, we've seen that that's not the case. Embryonic stem cell research has not been going on for as many years as adult stem cell research because embryonic stem cells were only first identified in the late 1990s. So the people who we oppose would say, well, the reason we haven't advanced as far as the adult stem cells is because we just haven't been doing the research for as long. But, of course, it gets me back to the question, is human life disposable? You know, is human life, early embryos, young embryos, you know, to be used at the whim of the researchers because people are sick and need cures? And that's where we would get back and say, no, that's a moral line we do not want to cross. Even if we were able to create and guarantee cures for people, we would never want to go down that road.
I certainly agree with you there. Well, let's talk a little bit about, have there been any complications with the embryonic stem cell research? In other words, is there certain things about the use of embryonic stem cells in animals or in human beings that creates all sorts of problems, much more so than the adult stem cells, which now we know a great deal more about them. So how would you compare the complications with embryonic stem cell use to that of adult stem cell use?
Right. Well, and therein lies the hope and promise that the researchers hold out, where they say that embryonic stem cell research, embryonic stem cells can do everything. They're the holy grail of stem cells. But in fact, the problem, because they can do everything, they've been quite difficult to control in the lab. So we have seen tumor formations. So when they take an embryonic stem cell and they try to force it into becoming a bone stem cell or a heart stem cell or a blood stem cell, they get the teratoma formations. And that's been problematic. They've been hard to control.
For our listeners, could you explain what a teratoma is? That's a medical term, but what does it mean?
Well, it's a tumor. It's a, you know, an unwieldy, growing out of control mass that is not, it's not organized and it's not able to be controlled. So that has been the problem with the embryonic stem cells, is these tumor formations. And, of course, when you're having tumor formations happening in the laboratory rat setting, the FDA is not going to approve for these to move forward and go into human clinical trials.
And I think for our listeners, a teratoma might be a tumor that would have a tooth in it, would have some skin, it would have some muscle tissue, it would have all different types of tissue. Certainly the stem cells, embryonic stem cells, have something known as the pluripotential. It's a fancy word meaning many potentials, pluripotential cells. And that's what they do. You inject them and some of them become teeth. And I mean, would you really want a tooth, you know, if you're trying to help the spinal cord recover, and tooth and skin and muscle and skin and all of these things form in these bizarre tumors? They call them teratomas. Go right ahead.
Yes, and it's unfortunate that they have been still in the media and the scientific community themselves like to talk about stem cells as if to lump them all together. So the unsuspecting public isn't able to maybe nuance the conversation and know that there are adult stem cells. There are adult stem cells that come from the patient themselves and then get used back in to treat the very patient. So you're treated with your own stem cells. There's adult stem cells that come from somebody else that, you know, that can be used to treat you and are being used to treat patients. And that's where, hands down, the scorecard, embryonic stem cell patient benefit, zero. Adult stem cell patient benefit, you know, 60, 70 different diseases and growing and counting every day. So, you know, where is the proof in the pudding? But the scientific community has not wanted to be limited. They've not wanted to be restricted. And we're seeing with the incoming administration, one of the first executive orders that we're told President-elect Obama will do is he will undo the Bush stem cell policy on embryonic stem cell research.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about adult stem cells. What has been accomplished with adult stem cells in the laboratory and in human trials? Because they have been used in human trials, so you pick up the story.
Yes, well, you know, as I said at the beginning, my background was in nursing, and you know, we have seen for many years, one of the patient populations I worked closely with was children with sickle cell anemia. And kids with sickle cell anemia, by and large today when they come in with crisis, are treated with umbilical cord blood stem cell stem cells. They get a transfusion of umbilical cord blood stem cells. We've seen clinical trials and patient applications with a whole host of diseases, even with spinal cord injury, and showing sensation and some return of movement in paralyzed limbs, diabetes, heart muscle, heart disease, MS. There's clinical trials happening right now outside of Chicago at Northwestern in multiple sclerosis.
Well, I think what you're saying is really so significant, the fact that there actually have been people who are paraplegic or quadriplegic where they've actually injected these stem cells into the spinal column, and there's been some reconstitution and some return in sensation. In fact, there have been even instances where people have been able to get up and take a few steps. Is that true?
It's absolutely true that they have had, again, we're talking about patient applications. You know, this is where a patient is in a clinical trial, in a study, receiving adult stem cell treatments. We don't want to say cures, but therapies and treatments that actually improve, mitigate the patient's disease, symptoms, whatever you want to say. But, yes, there's... I remember hearing a story of a woman who went in to provide Senate testimony, and she brought in two binders. One binder, she said, this is the evidence so far we have on embryonic stem cell helping patients, and the other is with adult stem cells. The embryonic stem cell binder was empty. You know, the adult stem cell binder was chock full of patients' testimonies, stories, records, clinical trials. Your listeners can go to clinicaltrials.gov and just type in stem cells, and you'll see pages and pages and pages of ongoing active clinical trials with human beings using adult stem cells. You'll see none in using embryonic stem cells.
But I think this is really what's so important, and we're not hearing about this in the controlled media, and they're focusing all of our attention on the debate over embryonic stem cells and never talking about the fact that there is no clinical application for them today, and yet there's all sorts of clinical application for adult stem cells, and some of the results have truly been just amazing. And certainly, what about the heart reconstitution? You know, have they been able to reconstitute heart muscle at all?
Yes, they've made a lot of progress in, especially when you think of a heart attack patient where there's been damaged heart muscle, in injecting, transfusing adult stem cells and finding, healing and regrowth of healthy heart muscle. I mean, part of the beauty of this whole field that we're talking about is what they call regenerative medicine. So it goes in and repairs and heals and encourages, you know, good healthy tissue growth. So heart muscle, even with diabetic patients, I've seen patients who have benefited who've had, you know, horrible gangrenous sores and limbs and wounds that wouldn't heal, just in skin and wound healing with adult stem cells. And, you know, we're out here in California where we all talk about renewable and recyclable and sustainable. Our organization, this May, is hosting in San Francisco a one-day conference on specifically the use of umbilical cord blood research. And we're trying to raise awareness because only about 3% of babies born in the United States today get their cord blood harvested, collected, and stored. And wouldn't it be nice to have 100% of babies born today and have that precious resource that normally just gets thrown away in the delivery room, you know, harvested, collected, stored, and saved, and go into a public bank available for people who need a stem cell transplant?
Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Our guest this evening is Jennifer Lall, and she's on the front lines of this. This battle is bioethics, but of course also the tremendous, you know, potential for adult stem cells. But remember, of course, the media can shape our reality, and they're shaping our reality. They're getting the wrong debate going. And what they're doing, of course, is taking us away from the advantage of the adult stem cells to a debate on the ethics of the embryonic stem cells, which is simply killing a potential human being. Why are they doing that? Why don't they tell us what's happening with the adult stem cells? Well, Jennifer, certainly there's so much more information about there on adult stem cells.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets. A little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
There's skin cells into stem cells. They're not embryonic cells, but they're stem cells that have the pluripotential. In other words, they have the ability to form all sorts of other tissues. And the beauty of that is that you do not get any rejection because it's your own DNA. The problem with embryonic stem cells is that you are taking somebody else's DNA and you are putting it into your body, and the body will tend to reject that, and then you're going to have to take all sorts of medication, and even if you take medicine, your body may well reject it, whereas the adult stem cells that come from you can be injected into you and have this amazing capacity for repair. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question for Jennifer, because she knows a lot more about this than I do. I've certainly talked to Dr. Wilkie and a few others about this, but I think it's a very important issue, and I think it should be certainly thoroughly understood by the people and the potential that we really have. And I've seen actual motion pictures of mice that have had their spinal cord severed, have been treated with mouse stem cells, and those mice are then able to regain the ability to walk again. And of course, this is the hope that this can be used in adults to actually regenerate the spinal cord, which we've never been able to do before. I mean, you had a spinal cord injury. It was usually, if it was a complete injury, you did not come back. And yet, of course, there is the potential. It takes a long time for these nerve cells to regenerate. Certainly, a mouse is a lot smaller, and they can regenerate a lot more quickly than a human being can. But there are some amazing, amazing stories that have been told. And you're not hearing about it out there in the listening audience because somebody doesn't want you to hear about it. Well, Jennifer, are you doing a lot of radio interviews, getting this information out?
A lot of radio interviews, a lot of speaking, a lot of writing, just standing at the top of the mountain and trying to scream as loud as we can, slowly but surely. One thing we're really excited about is this past year, our organization made a feature-length documentary on the great stem cell debates, and we're hoping to have that aired in the next month soon. It's finished, and it's before some key decision makers for, you know, a national television airing. So we're hopeful that once that airs and millions of people see it, that people will say, oh, we don't need to destroy embryos anymore. Adult stem cells is definitely the way to go.
Now, will this be available on DVD?
Yes, it will, and we will let people know. I'll be sure to let you know as soon as that comes out available as DVD. But we're shooting for a television release first and then straight to a DVD availability for the public.
And because the DVD is a wonderful means by which we get in people's living room, and we can circumvent it. Certainly, we'd hope you'd get on Discovery Channel, a History Channel, or
right. One
of the other channels there. But if you can't get it onto the channel, then we do hope, of course, that people across America will get these. And this is how we get information out. I'm so pleased. How did you manage to put together the DVD? Did you have some professional help? I mean, just putting together a DVD is something that takes a lot of talent and a lot of time and a lot of money.
Yes, well, we had to really work very hard to raise the budget, and we hired a state-of-the-art professional group out of Los Angeles that's in the business of making professional movies. It is very well made, and we have interviewed all sides of the debate, and we have some very powerful patient testimonies as part of the film too, which all the focus groups we've done showing the film, people are just amazed that they, and that's again gets back to the media. The general public hasn't a clue what really is at heart here at the debate. They do not understand that there's a difference between destroying embryos and using adult stem cells. They do not understand that adult stem cells have been helping patients for years and continue to help more and more patients every day, while embryonic stem cells are still stuck in the lab. And when people see this, whether they are conservatives or liberals or, you know, religious or not, they just, their eyes are opened to this. Just to the truth and the facts.
All right, fine. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience, this is one of the greatest advances, really, as far as I'm concerned, of the last century. And, of course, here we're just beginning of a new century. But really what medicine has accomplished in this field, I think, is something that, well, it's unparalleled, because the opportunity to really begin to heal some of the terrible damages to the brain or heart or other organs. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Jennifer Law. We're talking about, of course, stem cell research and the amazing things that have actually happened. Do you have any ideas, you know, of what's happened as far as the heart of people, you know, who have progressive congestive heart failure referable to heart damage? Have they been able to actually reverse some of that process?
Yes, they have. There's one particular researcher at Stanford who's done amazing work, specifically in the field of heart disease, using adult stem cells. And, you know, they're, like I said earlier, heart attack, congestive heart failure, just where there's been damaged heart muscle, adult stem cells regenerating and growing new, healthy heart tissue. So, yes, that is definitely one of the areas where there's, you know, real-life benefit to a patient's disease.
Now, how do they get that in? Do they actually infuse this in?
Yes, through the
coronary arteries? How do they inject it?
Yes, it's like getting a regular infusion of a cell infusion. Typically, if they're using the patient's own stem cells, there's some cleaning process that they take to, you know, remove the disease from the stem cells, and then they inject them back into the patient. Or if they're using just an adult stem cell transplant from another patient. What's in our film, what you hear a couple of the patients describing is their immune system or their body gets a reboot, like you reboot your computer. You shut it down and then you start it back up again and you've solved the problem. So you hear a lot of patients talking about after their transplant, it was as if my immune system or as if my body was rebooted. And gets it back on track so that it's functioning. Similar to, I suppose, how chemotherapy, you know, you try to kill all the diseased cells knowing that you'll kill healthy cells, but hoping after the fact the body will just naturally make healthy cells again and you've gotten rid of the cancer. So it's a similar concept where you are cleaning the cells if you're using the patient's own stem cells or, you know, infusing in an adult stem cell transfusion. And it reboots the body and starts repairing and making healthy, fresh cells.
Of course, and traditionally, you know, you had certain people with certain types of leukemia and lymphoma involving the bone marrow. While you would kill, they'd radiate and chemotherapy kill the bone marrow, and then you'd try to find a donor, you know, with the same type of a blood type, and it's very, very specific for the genotype of the individual.
Right.
And then, of course, you'd inject that to reconstitute the bone marrow, and when it worked beautifully. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jennifer Law. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we're talking about adult stem cell research. And we're talking about the ability to create stem cells that can actually rejuvenate certain parts of the nervous system, certain parts of the heart. And our telephone number, if you would like to call us, of course, again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question or comment. But Jennifer, would you like to get the information out on your website, on your organization, and how people might be able to get in touch with you and get your information if they're interested?
Yes, I would encourage everybody to go and visit our website. It's CBC, C as in Charlie, B as in baby, C as in Charlie, -network. .org. We put out a weekly email newsletter that is always chock full of information. It's not labor intensive to read. It's written for, you know, just lay persons to understand. So I would encourage everybody to visit our website and sign up to receive our free weekly email newsletter, and you'll know more about our film, when it's going to air, and what's going to happen once we change administrations in Washington, D.C. next week, and how that's going to affect policy. We keep everybody up to date on these matters.
Well, I'm a little concerned about the incoming administration and some of the things that it may very well do to to stop, you know, anything of a pro-life nature. Well, basically, what about things like Parkinson's disease or Huntington's chorea? Well, these are, of course, degenerative diseases of the central nervous system, the extrapyramidal system. Or what about victims of stroke? Is there any evidence that adult stem cells can help to rectify this sort of a situation?
Yes, there is a lot of advance in stem cell and neurological disorders. One of our speakers that will be at our umbilical cord blood conference this May in San Francisco, his area of research is in the area of pediatric stroke and pediatric neurological disorders using umbilical cord blood in treating neurological disorders. That's what's really exciting when we're watching the advances in cord blood research. In the early days, cord blood stem cells from the umbilical cord were predominantly used for the blood cancers or the blood diseases like sickle cell disease I mentioned earlier. But a lot of the researchers have been able to, again, back to the pluripotency, get the umbilical cord blood stem cells to be able to be used in diseases like diabetes and like neurological diseases and heart disease. So we're seeing a huge advance in the research and the progress using cord blood stem cells outside of the blood-based kind of diseases. And that gets me back to the need to raise awareness to start banking all these babies that are born every minute in the country so that we have a broad pool of stem cells available to help find matches for people, genetic matches, so that we can provide the best therapy for a person, a patient, when they need a treatment.
Well, Sydney, now, what about the diabetes? You know, what about the islands of Langerhans, which are in the pancreas, which are the precursors? They actually produce the insulin. Oh, is there any evidence that stem cell transfers can help the people with the, who don't have the islands of Langerhans?
Yes, there is. And again, getting back to visit the clinicaltrials.gov website and just type in stem cells and diabetes, and you will see all the active stem cell clinical trials that are happening right now. These are patient clinical trials, so it's advanced far enough that we can accept human beings as subjects into the research studies, and it's very encouraging. One of the speakers we'd hoped to have gotten to come to our conference in May is specifically doing his research with umbilical cord blood in juvenile diabetic patients. He unfortunately was already speaking and committed to present his research at another conference. But this is just, again, back to the frustration of the media and the scientific community that doesn't want the public to know that these advances in these clinical trials are taking place every day. They're looking for patients to enter into clinical trials. They're actively doing the clinical trials and all the phases that take a research concept to FDA approval for a patient's treatment. All along the way, patients in all these diseases, diabetes, neurological, stroke, heart disease, on and on and on, it's just a dirty little secret that people don't want us to know about.
And I think it's really terrible because there are tremendous potentials here. I mean, we live in an exciting time, and certainly science can be used for evil. Science can be used for good. But here's a place where it really can be used for good. And if you could, of course, rejuvenate or change the islands of Langerhans in a diabetic and certainly in a juvenile diabetic, so as they could begin to produce their own insulin, why you could transform their lives. Now, certainly in the type 2 diabetes, this seems to be more of an insulin-resistant situation. There is no real shortage of insulin. It's just the body tissues have been primed or some sort of allergic reaction to it. But certainly in the juvenile diabetes, well, of course, if they could once again reconstitute their islands of Langerhans, you could transform their lives and save so much suffering, because diabetes is really such a terrible, terrible disease. Well, again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. Our guest is Jennifer Lall, who, of course, is on the front lines of this battle, and there are all sorts of scientific studies being done today? Are a lot of these being actually financed by the government? Who's financing these stem cell research studies?
Yes, these are predominantly the ones I'm mentioning, and especially the ones that you'll find on the clinicaltrials.gov site. These are being funded by the National Institutes of Health, you know, which is funding hundreds of millions of dollars in stem cell research across the spectrum, using umbilical cord blood stem cells, using adult stem cells, and also, as I mentioned early on in the show, you know, at a limited amount, they are funding embryonic stem cell research as well.
All right, fine. Of course, now what about this? One of the things about stem cells is people say, but don't these have the capacity to produce cancer? Certainly, they can produce in the embryonic stem cells, produces teratomas, which are tumors. You certainly want to be injecting this into your brain if you've got Parkinson's disease, because there are actually, I know there have been, at least I've heard stories of experiments that were done on Parkinson's patients, knowing full well it was a chance, but they were so miserable with the disease, and they ended up with a teratoma there, you know, in that center. But what about the potential for these stem cells producing neoplasma cancers in adults? What do we know about that?
Well, we just know that they, in the embryonic stem cell research, that they have caused these cancers, these tumors. And that, again, back to my point, is why they haven't been approved for any kind of clinical trial usage, because they have not been able to prove that they can control the tumor formation in the laboratory, and the FDA is not going to prove them as being safe to enter into any kind of human clinical trials. But I still get so exercised around the scientific community that has so politicized science and has left the realm of science and jumped into, you know, politics and ethics and matters of funding, and gone are the days of the pure scientist who wants to do ethical research and wants to just be involved in answering the questions at which science can answer. And similarly, you know, the medical profession, which has abandoned its, you know, Hippocratic first do no harm tenets of the oath, and, you know, whether you call it a culture of death, or that we've just lost our moral way, or what? It's unfortunate that we have these wonderful advances and successes in a purely ethical way that can benefit patients today, and we're not putting all of our money and energies into pursuing that method of research.
Well, you said, but is there any problem with the adult stem cells as far as producing tumors are concerned?
No, there's no tumor formation whatsoever. Now, obviously, if you have an adult stem cell transplant that doesn't come from you, you may have to deal with some tissue rejection, but that has not been problematic. You know, because of course we have ways of addressing tissue rejection and finding, you know, the best possible match as we can get for patients. Just if you look at, you know, organ donation, you know, most of the time you get an organ from somebody who's not a genetic match with you, but we have, you know, means to address rejection. But there's been no problems with tumors whatsoever with adult stem cell.
Well, no, we've heard these stories that we might be able to actually to grow organs with these stem cells. Is there any truth to that? Is this a possibility to either grow a kidney or grow some other part of an organ that people need, or is this simply theoretical?
Yes, and I keep pointing back to our conference coming up in May, because one of the scientists who will be speaking at our conference is coming from Europe, Dr. Colin McGuckin. One of his claims to fame is that he was able to take umbilical cord blood stem cells and grow liver cells in the lab. So he was able to coax the umbilical cord blood stem cells into becoming liver cells. And that will be a huge regenerative advance for somebody someday who has, you know, liver damage, liver failure, liver disease, if we're able to, again, transfuse them with a adult stem cell transplant that will regenerate and repair and heal the damaged liver cells. So we have seen that happen already. And if we're able to do that, Unlike the stem cell researchers who want to clone human embryos so that they can have a cloned embryo and grow it long enough so that we have little liver cells and little kidney cells, this is an ethical way. You're not destroying an embryo, which I would say is human life. You can do that. You can do that in the lab with cord blood stem cells, and grow them and coax them to become liver cells.
Well, you know, Jennifer, the thing that really bothers me most about this whole issue is the fact that we seem to have lost our respect for human life. And of course, the most people who are very much strongly pro-life usually have some sort of a religious belief. They believe in the God and the Bible. They believe that human life is important. Unfortunately, though, we have a lot of scientists out there who do not value human life. And this is one of the real ethical problems we have today, because we have a lot of people out there who are not ethical.
Right, and that was what angered so many when President Bush introduced his stem cell policy, and he said, our children are creations, not commodities. And so many view the nascent, early human life embryo as a commodity, as a raw material, as a resource, and not as a fully human being deserving of rights and dignity.
Because this is one of the big problems that we find in our universities today, because I know I was a victim of a liberal education at the University of California in Berkeley, where they systematically work to destroy your faith in God and family and country and just about everything else. But the biggest thing, of course, was to destroy your faith in God so you would have no moral foundation. Or if we don't have a moral foundation, we can't live moral lives. And yet, of course, so many of the people with a great deal of education, I fear, educated far beyond their basic intelligence, and they have lost any understanding that every individual is a unique person made in the image and likeness of God. And you take God out of the equation, then anything goes. And certainly there's nothing wrong with what they did in the Nazi concentration camps. There's nothing wrong with experimenting on human beings. There's nothing wrong with embryonic stem cell research or abortion, or doing away with the lives of children who are deformed. I mean, this is the real problem we have, and you as an ethicist and just certainly with bioethics research, doesn't this, of course, really crystallize what it's all about? Isn't it really almost a battle between those who believe in a God, in a supreme human being to whom we're all answerable, and those who believe that they can do whatever they want to, as long as they want to?
Absolutely. I mean, it gets us back. I mean, I'm mindful of today. They had the funeral services for Father Richard John Newhouse, who was the founding editor of a wonderful journal called First Things. And we've lost our first principles. And we have to ask people all the time, well, why do you believe that? Why do you think it's okay to destroy this life? Why do you think this life doesn't matter? Why do you think it's okay for a patient to terminate his life? Why, you know? And when you dig down, you see that people have no moral foundation to build upon. So we're left with opinions and ideas and just what I feel like. Well, I feel that this is what we should do, and we have to do this. But there's no why. There's no foundation there for building upon, and that's why we see an aggressive move towards physician-assisted suicide. I think in 2009 we'll see one, if not two, more states legalize physician-assisted suicide. The news this week that came across my desk was we are now we just had a little girl born for the first time ever who was born without the breast cancer genetic marker, because there was a strong history of genetic breast cancer in the family. So they made a bunch of embryos. They found the one that was free of that genetic marker and implanted her and let her be born. So the big headline was, isn't this great? We now can have children born without, that will never get breast cancer. Well, what does that say to the other embryos that didn't make the cut? That you're better off dead than being born with a gene that might cause you to have breast cancer down the way. We have zero tolerance for sickness, for disease, for suffering. We just want to avoid it all, and we don't want to be told right and wrong, good and bad.
And we don't want people to believe that there are absolutes and there is a right and there is a wrong. And I love that phrase by Ravi Zacharias. You know, he talks about, you know, debating this idea. Is there right? Is there wrong? Are there absolutes? Is there a God? And he says, you know, of course, to the people on the other side of the debate, you know, there's some people who say that, you know, you say there's no right or there's no wrong. Well, what about there's some people who want to love their neighbors or other people who want to eat their neighbors? Which one is right?
Right, absolutely.
And of course, if we take away the concept of God, then anything goes. And this is the problem that we have today. It is the end result of what the educational program we have, where they will not allow mention of God in school. And the reason they took God out of our schools, and prayer out of our schools, and Christmas out of our schools, and the Ten Commandments out of our schools, is because I believe there's an organized effort to destroy the moral foundation of our country. It did not happen by accident. If you're out there in the listening audience, you've not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it and you need to read it. Everybody talks about what the Supreme Court did, but nobody will ever tell you why they did it. And that, of course, is the real $64,000 question. First of all, why did they do it? And then why will we never discuss why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools? Because it's not because there's a wall of separation of church and state in the Constitution, because there isn't. Well, Jennifer, you've got...
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Get people really educated about what is going on. Once again, our telephone number, if you'd like to get more information, like to get my book on Brotherhood of Darkness, or my talk on the Forbidden Secret, because the two of them go together, and there's a syllabus that goes with the Forbidden Secret, and you have to understand there is a master plan for everything going on today. And this whole idea of destroying the children's belief in God. This is not happening by accident. There really are people out there who hate the God of the Bible, who hate the message of the Ten Commandments, who are consumed by hatred of everything worthwhile and good. And when you understand that, you can understand the moral breakdown of our society, the teaching of perversion in our schools, the justification of all sorts of immorality. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we do hope that many of you out there, of course, will go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there on the Internet and up to 9 hours a day to Radio Liberty. Of course, 4 hours is live, the rest of it's rebroadcast. But there are MP3, there are blog programs, there are archive programs of myself, and then, of course, Joyce Riley and some of our other friends on our satellite feed. And you can listen to that satellite feed. It goes 24 hours a day. If you need to, you can get one, an inexpensive satellite, so you can pull those programs down if you're in an area where you don't get good reception. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll want to get more information on every aspect of the things we talk on. We do have a 4-tape set on the murder of Martin Luther King. He was killed as part of a CIA-funded hit. And, of course, there was a trial that was held, not a word in the controlled media, but the assassination of Martin Luther King, a fascinating 4-tape set. And then the book that was written by the lawyer who was hired by Martin Luther King's family to bring the suit, it was called An Act of State. This is the book, and it's then we have a 4-tape set on the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And, of course, we have 2 4-tape sets. We have a DVD. And then, of course, we have two books. The Elite Serial Killers. The Elite Serial Killers and A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza. And you want to get the books. You want to understand they killed the President of the United States. And, of course, they got away with it because they controlled the media and because at least 3 or 4 of the members of the Warren Commission were Masons, and 3 of them came from the Council on Foreign Relations, which came out of Masonry. And, of course, there were 2 people on the Warren Commission who didn't believe the decisions of the Warren Commission. One was Hale Boggs. And when his plane went down in Alaska, with Nick Baker's dad, who was running for Congress at the time, the government knew where the plane was, and they refused to allow any